A very good morning to you all. Welcome. So nice to see a large crowd. People are still coming in, but we're going to get rolling because we want to use the hour well. And I can see looking out, the sun peeping, which is great, good news. And we're looking forward to a very good day together here in Keswick. Please do come in, find a seat as quickly as you can, and a very warm welcome to our Keswick lecture. In case you're not familiar with this idea, each week of the convention for about the last 14 or 15 years, I think, we have included within the program what is called the Keswick lecture. And we've done that in order to address themes which are of contemporary significance for the church, for evangelicals, for our society. And so we take a pause from our usual Bible teaching in order to focus on a topic of critical significance. We want it still to be biblically shaped and informed, but we're always glad to have people who can speak with authority in a particular area and often related to our theme. Now, as you know, our theme this year is going the distance. We're thinking about living now in the light of the future. And almost inevitably, with that theme, of course, we confront the issue of dying. And much as we did last night from Ecclesiastes, so this morning we're going to look at this theme of euthanasia and assisted suicide. Do we have a right to die? And so we're especially glad to welcome John Wyatt. There is no better person, in my view, to address this and to steer us through this rather complex debate. He's the Emeritus Professor of Neonatal Pediatrics at University College London, and he's also the chair of the Medical Study Group for CMF, the Christian Medical Fellowship, for which we're very grateful in this country. And he's given a great deal of thought to these ethical issues, but also brings a very wide biblical understanding, considerable medical experience, and in my view, a tough mind and a tender heart, which need to be brought together on issues such as this. So I'd like you, please, to welcome John Wyatt. He won't speak immediately, but it would be nice to welcome him warmly. John, we're glad to have you. The other thing to mention that John is also the author of this title, Matters of Life and Death. I read it in its first edition. It's now expanded. And this is a wonderful compendium of the human dilemmas that we face and how we think about those from a Christian perspective. It includes reproductive technology, biotechnology and stem cells, abortion, the dilemmas of a dying baby, as well as this morning's subject. So it's an extremely good book. And there are several signings taking place for the authors who are on site. People are glad to get a book with a signature. It increases its value no end, I think, doesn't it, John, to have your signature in it? So after the lecture, and between the lecture and the Bible reading, stage right, if you over here on my left, or your right, John will sit with a little pile of books, and he'll be very glad to say hello and quickly sign it for you. So IVP will provide a little stock, and you can do that immediately after the lecture. I should add also that we're working, John, very hard today because at lunchtime we have these conversations, as you know, with various people over at St. John's, and John has very kindly agreed to be the person in conversation at lunchtime today. So at 1 o'clock at St. John's, lunch, you're welcome to order that at reception, or bring your own lunch, or just pop in and sit for an interview which will take place with John, particularly on the issues of this morning's lecture. So I'd like to mention that if you have questions which arise from what John presents to us in just a moment, if you would like to bring those to the stage afterwards and just pass them to me or to one of the stewards down here, then I will bring them up at lunchtime and we'll be able to discuss those with John. I think also it'll be sufficiently informal that you can ask questions in that session at 1 o'clock as well. John will also be doing two seminars, which begin tomorrow and on Friday, and I think he would also welcome questions in advance. Perhaps he will refer to those in a moment. So thank you very much for joining us, and we're going to pray, and then I will hand over to John. Let's pray. As we do so, I'd like to read some words from Psalm 90, which is a prayer attributed to Moses. Lord, you have been our dwelling place throughout all generations. before the mountains were born, or you brought forth the earth and the world, from everlasting to everlasting, you are God. You turn men back to dust, saying, Return to dust, O sons of men. For 1,000 years in your sight are like a day that has just gone by, or like a watch in the night. Teach us to number our days aright, that we may gain a heart of wisdom. Come to you this morning as our Father and our Creator, as the everlasting Lord, the one who holds our lives in his hand, who holds this entire universe in his hand, who knows the end from the beginning. And yet, Lord, you've placed us here with all kinds of mysteries and uncertainties by virtue of our humanity, our mortality, the limits of our understanding. Yet you've also given good gifts to men as the Creator God, to medics, to those who can extend and sustain our lives. We also live in a broken world where there is so much sorrow at the beginning and the middle and the end of life. So we pray that as we reflect on this very demanding but significant issue this morning, you will give our brother John much wisdom as he addresses us, and that you'll help us to think carefully, rigorously about the issue as it impacts men and women in our culture, as it is shaped by the principles of your word, and as it informs our pastoral care. We ask for this in Jesus' name. Amen. And again, let's welcome John as he comes to speak to us.
Well, thanks so much for that very warm welcome. It's a real privilege for me to be able to share this morning and take the lecture on this painful and difficult subject. I've worked for more than 30 years in the area of medicine, particularly in care of the newborn, but issues of death and dying have been a central issue for my own clinical career, as well as in our society as a whole. I've recently stopped from my clinical work and become an emeritus professor. I've had the privilege of knowing John Stott for many years, and when he became rector emeritus at All Souls Church, and he was asked, what does emeritus actually mean, John? He would explain with great concern and care. He would say, well, it's derived from two Latin words, e or ex, meaning out of it, and emeritus, meaning undeservedly so. So that's a bit how I feel at the moment, but I'm pleased to tackle this painful issue. If you've come expecting some neat, simple answers and solutions to complex, difficult, challenging questions, then I'm afraid you're going to be disappointed, because I haven't got any neat, simple solutions. In fact, I don't believe there are any neat or simple solutions. But I hope that together we can try and explore both what is happening in our society at the moment in this area, but also some foundational Christian principles and ways in which this can apply. There should be a way out for rational people who have decided they are in the negative. That should be available, and it should be easy. There should be a booth on every corner where you could get a martini and a medal. The words were deliberately flippant, but Martin Amis had seen the protracted death of loved ones at close quarters, and he didn't want to go the same way. And he's just one of a whole chorus of media voices calling for the legalization of assisted suicide. And as we all know, we've seen on our television screens and in the newspapers a steady stream of despairing suicides who make the journey to the Zurich clinic Dignitas. Like the elderly and frail conductor, Sir Edward Downes, and his wife. She had cancer, he was just elderly, deaf and frail, and they'd entered into a suicide pact together. They were going to kill themselves. And they went off to Zurich and were killed. Or the disabled GP, Anne Turner, she'd nursed her husband with degenerative condition, a neurological condition, and then to her horror she'd seen the same signs starting in herself, She tried to kill herself, had failed, and then she persuaded her family to take her to Zurich. And it's interesting reading the accounts of the bind, the conflict that the family found themselves in. They were torn, as so often, between a sense of horror that their mother wanted to kill herself and pleading with her to change her mind, and yet also a sense of loyalty to their loved one. If you really loved me, you would help me to die. And so they went with her to Zurich, and she was killed. Or the tragic story of Daniel James, a young rugby player, played for the England junior team, and then a terrible accident, spinal cord paralysis, paralyzed from the neck downwards. He becomes depressed, and then he decides the only way out is to kill himself. And again, he persuades his parents, if you really loved me, you'd take me to kill myself. And they go to the clinic with his parents. And afterwards, the press, by and large, are very supportive of Daniel's parents, saying, you know, what a loving thing to do. Weren't they really loving, caring parents? That they did the best for Daniel. And the prominent philosopher Mary Warnock spoke out publicly saying that they'd acted in a loving and moral way. Recently, there's the tragic case of Tony Nicholson with a rare syndrome, a kind of stroke called the locked-in syndrome, which means that he's really lost control almost of entire parts of his body. The only thing he can do is blink, and this is his way of communicating. And he's come to the conclusion that his life is hopeless and pointless, and he wants to die, but he can't kill himself. And so he's gone to the courts to argue that doctors should have the right to kill him and to take his life. Well, the case of Nan Maitland, whose obituary appeared recently. At first glance, it's a completely normal obituary. She's the founder and president of Homeshare International. Her vision, energy, and inspiration will be missed by all of us around the world. But then, when you read on, it turns out that she'd sent a letter to all her friends after her death. By the time you read this, with the help of friends at the end and the good Swiss, I would have gone to sleep, never to wake. For some time, my life has consisted of more pain than pleasure, and over the next months and years, the pain will be more and the pleasure less. For many years, I fear the long period of decline, sometimes called prolonged dwindling, that so many people unfortunately experience before they die. Please be happy for me that I have been able to escape from this, for me, unbearable future. With my death on March the 1st, I feel I am fully accepting the concept of old age rational suicide, which I've been very pleased to promote as a founder member of the Society for Old Age Rational Suicide. And some people are saying this is the way forward. This is the way that old people should behave. What a responsible, what a thoughtful, what a caring way to end your life. But of course, these are not just important philosophical and theological issues. They are issues of human pain. And you know, we must always remember, before we sort of start talking about theology or philosophy or theories and ethics, we must always remember the human pain that lies behind these issues. The fact that these are people who struggle and bleed and agonize and worry and fear what dying is going to hold. So if you like, we should talk about these issues wherever we talk about them, not with judgment or with fear in our voices, but with tears in our eyes. We have to empathize, to enter into the human experience. But of course, these are not just issues out there in society as a whole. No, these are issues in here, in this tent. I don't know most of you, but I can guarantee that many of us are touched by these issues ourselves. We may be facing our own mortality. We may know that we have a terminal condition and we're wondering what the future is going to hold. We may be waiting for the results of tests from a hospital, or we may be watching a loved one struggle or facing dementia or disability and wondering, is it really right to carry on to the end? Or maybe it would be a Christian thing to accept death and to say perhaps suicide is the right way forward. So these are not just issues for other people. These are for all of us, because of our own humanity, because of the way that God has made us. Debates about euthanasia and assisted suicide are not new. They've been going on for many years. In the 1990s, there was a creation of a parliamentary commission into whether legalization in the UK should be changed to allow mercy killing. At that time, the major focus was on people who were dying in terrible, uncontrollable pain, especially those with terminal cancer. After detailed investigation, the House of Lords voted decisively against a change of the law. Instead, they emphasized the need to develop effective palliative care for terminally ill patients. Now, 15 years later, the debate about medical killing has resurfaced, but now the issues are strikingly different. Now the central issue is not pain, it's about the right to choose. It's about the right to control one's own existence. And the diseases in focus are no longer cancer, but they're chronic neurological conditions, such as motor neurone disease, and multiple sclerosis, and spinal atrophy. And these are conditions which don't primarily cause pain, although multiple sclerosis can be a painful condition, but they're conditions which affect primarily our ability to choose, our ability to control ourselves, what the philosophers call autonomy. In 2006, the Voluntary Euthanasia Society changed its name to Dignity in Dying. Those words are very significant. And their website studiously avoids straightforward words such as euthanasia, suicide, or mercy killing. Instead, it uses vague and euphemistic terms, such as a dignified death for all, patient choice at the end of life, assistance to die, the choice to end suffering if it becomes unbearable. A recurring theme in medical ethics is how language is manipulated to make ethically controversial actions more acceptable. One of the things we need to be on the lookout for is the way that language is being twisted and manipulated. So often, the manipulation of language precedes a widespread change in ethical behavior. It demonstrates how important language is to the way human beings make moral decisions. Killing sounds so harsh, so blunt, so shocking. So much nicer to talk about assisted dying, easeful death, or death with dignity. But it's important to be clear about words. There is a proverb which says, "The beginning of wisdom is to call things by their proper names." And this is very true in the area of medical ethics. And so here is a definition of what we mean by euthanasia. Literally in Greek, just euthanasia means euthanatos, a good death. But what it actually means is intentional medical killing. The intention is to bring death into a situation. It is to bring death where it isn't. And it's medical killing of a person whose life is thought not to be worth living. And physician-assisted suicide is very close to this. It is intentional medical killing, but it's the final act is performed by the patient. It's intentional killing at one remove. In the case of seriously disabled patients who require help in ending their lives, computer-controlled devices can be used which inject lethal mixtures at the push of a button or even at the blink of an eyelid. The doctor provides the means, calculates the lethal dose, draws up the drugs, attaches the apparatus. He explains what to do and how to do it, but the doctor draws back from the final act. But can you actually say that that's any different from pressing the syringe? Is there really any difference? Morally and spiritually, I think these two actions are virtually the same. In both euthanasia and physician-assisted suicide, there is intentional medical killing, a deliberate and premeditated act designed to take life, to introduce death. In the UK and the USA, assisted suicide is seen as more acceptable to the public than euthanasia. And that's why the activists, the pro-euthanasia activists, are concentrating attention to try to encourage and persuade the public to change the law. And they're being very successful. At the moment, 80% or more of the population say they're in favor of the change in the law to allow assisted suicide. One of the fascinating things is that if you just ask people out in the community if they're in favor of this kind of thing, A majority of people say yes. The closer you get to people who care for dying people, so if you take doctors as a whole, the percentage drops. If you take doctors who care for elderly people, the percentage drops again. If you take doctors who are involved in palliative care, the percentage drops to a very low level. The people who actually know what they're talking about are almost uniformly opposed to a change in the law. But out there in the community, there's a very different perspective. Euthanasia is not the same as withdrawing medical treatment, which is futile or burdensome. This is just good medicine. There is no reason, either medically or theologically or biblically, to give treatment which can bring no benefit, which is futile, which is purposelessness, which is damaging. And so stopping medical treatment, which is futile, is good medicine. And euthanasia is not the same as giving pain-killing treatment in order to benefit the patient, which may have the unintended side effect of shortening life. That's what some philosophers call the principle of double effect, and it's recognizing the difference between intention, intending to kill, and foresight. Several years ago, I had the opportunity to engage in public debate with a well-known and highly respected campaigner for euthanasia, and I was struck by his words. He said to me, basically, I'm afraid. It's not so much that I'm afraid of death, but I'm afraid of the process of dying. And so it seems to me that there are some terrible deep-seated fears at the heart of this debate. And here are three of them. Fear of suffering. Now, what we mean is much more than just physical pain. It's what the palliative care specialists call total pain. It's a concept which includes physical pain, but is also emotional, relational, and spiritual pain. Total pain is hard to define. It's distress which has many components. But you take an elderly person dying from cancer. They're in physical distress because the disease has spread to the bones. They're in psychological distress because they're frightened at what the future may hold. Will the pain get worse and worse? Will he have to leave his home and be admitted to hospital? The person's in relational distress because the family is putting on a brave face and refusing to acknowledge the reality of what is happening. And he's in spiritual distress because he's confronting the ultimate reality of death without any sense of meaning or purpose. What is there to hope for? What has his life been for? That's total pain. It involves every aspect of his life and being. And as a society, we have lost the belief that pain, that suffering, can have any positive value at all. Pain is useless, futile, destructive, incomprehensible, terrifying. For many philosophers and many others, the whole purpose of existence is to maximize personal happiness and minimize pain. So if we can't be happy, then at least we can try to get rid of the pain. We can use anesthesia any way possible just to get rid of that terrible, gnawing pain. But it's not just fear of suffering. There's also the fear of indignity. With modern medical care, most people are not in great physical pain when they die. But to die with a tube in every orifice, with a rubber sheet on the bed in case you make a mess like a child, to require help even to have a shave or to comb your hair, it's not the way we want to live. It's undignified. And there's a great fear of over-treatment, of ending up your life on an intensive care unit with doctors who don't know when to stop. And out of that great fear of that indignity, surely euthanasia would be a better way out. Surely suicide would be a responsible way. But then finally, there's the most deep-rooted fear of all, the fear of becoming dependent and of losing our freedom. Many people argue that a person's way of death should fit with how that person has lived the rest of their life. Otherwise, a bad death might mar the whole story of a life, just as a bad ending can ruin a beautiful novel. If I have lived my life by choosing, taking responsibility for my own existence, writing my own script, as some people put it, then I must be free to end my life in my own way, in a way that fits. Modern Western people believe in the right of self-determination, the right of autonomy. And it seems self-evident to many that this right must include the right to self-destruction. I should have the right to destroy myself. So one way modern people cope with these deep-rooted fears is to hope for a rapid and unexpected death. Whereas to many previous generations, sudden death was seen as a tragedy. To be catapulted into eternity without the chance of preparation, without the chance of repentance, of saying goodbye, that was seen as something terrible. But it's fascinating to see how now people say, actually, that's the way I want to go. When modern people, including many Christians, are asked how they wish to die, the most common response is, I want to die suddenly in my sleep. I don't want to be a burden to others. I want to die suddenly, and I don't want to know what is going on. But is that really a good death? But if we do not go quickly, if we have to face the ultimate horror of a slow, protracted dying, then we want assisted suicide. That way, we do not need to be afraid. We can relax. We can face our death with equanimity. There will be someone there to help. Euthanasia seems to be an answer to our deepest fears. But if fear is the main force driving the euthanasia debate, there are other, more sinister forces out there, though they're rarely talked about in public. One of the things is the demographic time bomb, so-called, the aging population. I must say, as I look out across this tent, I see the demographic time bomb. Here is the aging population. Brothers and sisters, we're all part of it. And so some people have projected a nightmarish vision of the future in which large numbers of isolated and abandoned elderly people are kept alive to suffer a pointless, lonely, and degrading existence. Thanks to improvements in medical care, of particular concern is the growing epidemic of Alzheimer's disease and other forms of dementia. According to current predictions, someone born now has a 1 in 3 chance of developing dementia in their lifetime. Moral philosopher Mary Warnock has argued in favor of medical killing in these cases. If you're demented, you're wasting people's lives, your family's lives, and you're wasting the resources of the NHS. I'm absolutely fully in agreement with the argument that if pain is insufferable, then someone should be given help to die. But I feel there's a wider argument that if somebody is absolutely desperately wants to die because they're a burden to their family or state, then I think they too should be allowed to die, by which she means they should be killed. They can choose to be killed. Over 30% of elderly people living in care homes are socially isolated and receive few or no visits from relatives or friends. It's been estimated that over 200,000 elderly people in the UK are being physically or mentally abused every year. Are we surprised that there is a pressure for euthanasia and assisted dying? Then there are spiraling healthcare costs, particularly at the end of life. And there's a desperate shortage of organs for transplants. The supply of organs coming mainly from accident victims has steadily declined. Death by lethal injection offers the prospect of an almost limitless supply of transport of organs. Think of how much good we could do for other people. So euthanasia seems like a technical solution to all these complex problems. I like the words of H.L. Mencken. There's always an easy solution to every human problem. Neat, plausible, and wrong. So if euthanasia is not the answer to these terrible problems, what on earth is? And how can we think about these issues from a Christian point of view? So let me just lay out some principles for us to think about from a Christian point of view. I don't have any easy answers, but here are some principles to help our thinking and our practical caring. I can't deal with all the aspects of this complex and difficult subject. So if there are specific questions or issues you'd like to raise, please write your question down, and there'll be opportunities to discuss these, both this lunchtime, as you've heard, and also in the seminars on Thursday and Friday morning. So first of all, the intentional destruction of an innocent human life is an affront to God himself. In Christian thinking, a human life is not just a gift of God's grace. It's a reflection of his being. human beings are made in God's image. They are God-like beings. And therefore, when you destroy the life of a human life, when you bring death into that human life, in some sense, you are desecrating that mysterious and precious image. Some will argue that mercy killing can be seen as a way of helping, of protecting vulnerable people. Doesn't it protect them from suffering? But no, biblical thought always draws a line between removing suffering and removing the sufferer. In biblical thinking, human life is sacrosanct. We're not at liberty to destroy innocent human life, however noble may be the motive. And here are the solemn words of the 9th chapter of Genesis, in what scholars have called the Lex Talionis. Whoever sheds the blood of man, by man shall his blood be shed. Why? Because in the image of God has God made man. So as biblical scholars have pointed out, this text combines two profound biblical themes. On the one hand, there is the shedding of blood, the taking of life, but it's linked to the indwelling image of God. In Christian thinking, the destruction of an innocent human life is always wrong, not only because of the wrong to the individual and the community, but also because it is a profound insult to the being and character of God himself. God's masterpiece cannot be destroyed lightly. This is why Orthodox Christian thought has always been opposed not only to homicide, the taking of another human life, but also to suicide, the destruction of one's own life. That too is a desecration of God's image. In many ancient cultures, suicide has been glorified as a noble way to die. The Norwegian warriors saw suicide as a path to heaven. In Buddhism, self-immolation is a wonderful example of the renunciation of desire. In Japan, until recently, harikiri was a noble form of death. In ancient Greece, the Stoics encouraged the heroic suicide. But in all cultures influenced by the Judeo-Christian revelation, suicide has never been glorified. It's always been opposed. It's never glorified in the Bible. Samson, that flawed and ambiguous character, is the only example of a heroic and desperate suicide whose act is in some sense approved. But in the rest of the Bible, suicide is associated with godlessness. Think of Judas Iscariot or Saul and their tragic ends. Self-destruction is a harm to be avoided, not a human right to be assisted. Despite this, it must be said that suicidal thoughts are actually quite common in God's people. Elijah wanted to die, but was sent on a sabbatical instead. Job wishes he'd never been born, but has to learn that God is in control of his life. And I want to be honest and say that I too have experienced a period of severe depression in which I too was overwhelmed by thoughts of suicide. Wouldn't that have been the easiest way out? Where my life seemed hopeless and despairing. But thank God that someone didn't come along and say, well, here's some tablets, here's the injection, just sign on the form, we can help you. Thank God instead I was met by love, by compassion, and by the Christian caring community, by God's love in physical form, God's love with skin on. So in the Bible, in all societies influenced by Christianity, suicide is never glorified. It's a pagan way to die. But what is interesting is in our post-Christian society, suicide is being rehabilitated, reintroduced, re-glorified as a responsible, as a thoughtful, as a rational way to die. God gives human beings wonderful and terrifying freedom of action. We're free to act and choose as responsible moral agents who are accountable to one another and accountable to God himself. But there are God-given limits to our freedom as moral agents. And the limits are part of the hidden moral order of the creation, the moral warp and woof, the way God has designed reality. And one of those moral limits which we must not go over, is to choose to destroy my own life or the life of another. Gilbert Mylander put it like this: within the story of my life, I have the relative freedom of a creature, but it is not simply my life to do with it as I wish. Suicide expresses a desire to be free and not also finite, a desire to be more like the creator than the creature. And yet there is a paradoxical character to Christian thinking about laying down one's life. After all, Jesus is the supreme example of a life deliberately laid down for others. To sacrifice one's own life for the good of others, or in the face of persecution, is the height of Christian love. So what is the difference? Well, sacrificing your life because there's something worth dying for is martyrdom. It's an act of hope, of faith, of love. Sacrificing your life because there's nothing worth living for is suicide. It's an act of despair. It's an act of hopelessness. The Christian martyr doesn't aim at death, but aims to be faithful to God, foreseeing that death may occur as a result. In fact, it's exactly the same distinction I mentioned earlier, the distinction between intention and foresight. The martyr intends to serve God, but foresees that he may have to die, he or she may die in the process. Forbidding suicide and honoring martyrs, the early Christians recognized life as a real but not ultimate good, a great good but not the highest good. So that's the first principle. The second is that dependence is not evil. We saw how terrified modern people are about the idea of dependence. But actually, dependence is part of God's plan. It's part of God's design for us as human beings, embodied and frail. It's part of the narrative of a person's life. It's not an alien, subhuman, undignified condition. You came into this world utterly and totally dependent on other people to love and care for you. When you were born, you could do nothing for yourself. And the very fact you're sitting there now tells me that somebody loved you, somebody fed you, somebody wiped your bottom, somebody kept you warm, otherwise you wouldn't be here. And then we go through a phase when other people depend on us. I've got, Celia and I, my wife, we have three grown-up boys, and I'm still going through this phase when other people depend on us. And the phone rings, and say, Dad, can you put £200 into my account? Dad, can I have the car? Dad. So I'm still going through that phase. But most of us are going to end our lives utterly and totally dependent on the love and care of others. And that is not an evil, terrible, undignified thing. No, that is part of the plan. I've talked about my mother and the death of my mother previously in this convention, but I say it again because it made such a great impact on me. My mother, some of you know her, was a wonderful, vivacious, articulate lady, and then she was struck down by a terrible progressive brain disease, and she became utterly and utterly dependent. She could do nothing for herself. She was confused, she was hallucinating, she was requiring 24-hour nursing care. And towards the end, I was visiting her, and somebody thrust a yogurt pot and a teaspoon into my hand. And I was trying to feed her. Open your mouth, here it comes. And then I had that flashback. This was precisely what she used to do for me. And now, in a strange way, the tables were turned, and here I was, feeding, caring for my mother, almost like a baby. And I remember thinking at the time, you know, this is the way it was meant to be. I was learning more of what it meant to be a son, and she was learning more of what it meant to be a mother. Dependence is part of the plan. God could have made us strong, resilient, dynamic, self-sufficient, but instead he chose to make us fragile, weak, vulnerable, contingent, and dependent on one another. I often hear old people, including Christian old people, and I bet there are some sitting here today, say something like this: I just don't want to be a burden to anybody else. I'm very happy to care for others. I'm very happy to look after other people. But if I ever get to the point where I start to be a burden to somebody else, I'm going to say to the Lord, thank you very much, Lord, I've had enough, now it's time to go to heaven, thank you very much, time to go. If you ever hear somebody say that, or if you're ever tempted to say it yourself, then you must immediately say, you are wrong. You are designed to be a burden to me, and I am designed to be a burden to you. And the life that God has given us, the human life, the embodied life, is one of mutual burdensomeness. That's why Paul says, bear one another's burdens, and in this way you will fulfill the law of Christ. But the Christian faith teaches us something even more wonderful and amazing. Because God himself, the God of the universe, breaks into the world, how? As a pathetic, vulnerable, fragile, and totally defenseless newborn baby. We're so familiar with the doctrine of the incarnation that we've lost its scandalous force. God makes himself a baby who can do nothing for himself. A baby who depends on human breasts for milk, on human hands to wipe his bottom. Jesus starts his life totally dependent on the love and care of others. And at the end of the life, on the cross, with his arms stretched out through parched lips, all he can croak is, I am thirsty. And yet, at the very time that he is utterly and totally dependent, the Christian faith teaches us he is upholding the universe by the word of his power. His dignity, his status as the second person of the Trinity is in no way touched by his dependence. So please remember that. If you have to end up in hospital, utterly and totally dependent on the love and care of others, and other people have to feed you, and other people have to wipe your bottom, your unique dignity, your status, your value as a person known and loved by God will not in the slightest bit be touched. Dependence is part of the story, and God himself entered into the story in order to go with us. And as somebody put it, he was with us in the darkness of the womb as he will be with us in the darkness of the tomb. There's nothing you can go through in the human narrative which in some sense God himself in the person of Jesus has been through as well. Thirdly, death and the evils of aging are the consequences of the fall. We were not intended to die. We were made to live forever. Death is a mysterious, terrible, alien interruption in the nature of being. It's the final enemy which we fight against. And the evils of old age are real evils. Fatigue, pain, confusion, anxiety. But old age itself is not an evil. It's part of the human narrative. A stage of life to be respected and honored. A time for learning new experiences and for facing new challenges. And then fourthly, death can be a severe mercy, even a strange form of healing. Christian thinking about death always has a strange ambivalence. Death is not to be welcomed or hastened. Death is the final enemy, but it can on occasion, by God's grace, turn into a severe mercy, into a strange form of healing, into a gateway into a new heaven and a new earth. So Christian attitudes to death reflect both a sense of outrage at its alien, destructive character, but also an acceptance that the end of physical life can actually be a severe mercy, and a sense of future hope in the knowledge that ultimately, as we are told in Revelation, death will be destroyed. Jesus both shows us the importance of our current physical bodies, but points to something that is even more important, the future resurrection life, which is invading the present. He shows us that our present limited physical existence is not the only or even the most important part of reality. So we recognize the importance of physical healing while seeing that there's a deeper, richer reality, an even more wonderful being, which lies beyond death. So we can't make extending physical life the ultimate goal of medicine. Sometimes we have to say no to medical progress. Sometimes we shall need the trust and the courage that enabled us to say no to what medical technology makes possible. This physical existence is not all there is. Sometimes we need a deeper healing. One of the problems with modern society is that we've medicalized death in the process of dying. Death is something that happens in hospitals when the constant struggle against disease is finally lost. So dying has become a medical event. It's something to do with doctors and nurses and tablets and injections. But actually, no, that's wrong. Dying is not primarily a medical event. Dying is a spiritual event with medical implications. So if intentional medical killing is not the answer, then what is? Well, whenever we say that something is wrong, we must immediately say, and here is a better way. So what is the better way? Well, in the 1950s and 1960s, Christian doctors were confronted with an appalling dilemma. There were growing numbers of older people who were surviving into old age, but they were dying slowly of cancer and painfully. And what on earth should you do as a Christian doctor? Should you watch them struggle and die in agony, or should you kill them to put them out of their misery? So this was the terrible alternative which Christian doctors face. What do you do when you confront two unacceptable alternatives? Do you choose the lesser evil? No, you don't. What you do is you invent a new way, a different way of caring. And that's what some Christian doctors did. They invented a completely new way of caring. And one of them was this remarkable lady, Cicely Saunders, a Christian doctor in London who eventually set up a hospice at St. Christopher's. And you know, she was a remarkably innovative, creative, caring person. She saw the need to invent a new way of caring that for dying people that matched with Christian principles and Christian thinking. And I've become convinced that perhaps the single most important attribute we need as carers is creativity. Often it seems we don't lack compassion, we don't lack expertise, we don't lack resources, but we seem to lack the creativity, the originality, the ability to innovate, the ability to see a new way forward. And Cicely Saunders provided a wonderful example of innovative Christian caring. Caring that refuses to accept old defeatist attitudes. So modern palliative care came up with a new way, a multidisciplinary way of caring for dying people. And in the words of one of the slogans, not only will we help you to die with dignity, but we will help you to live before you die. It's a positive and practical alternative to euthanasia. It's not necessary to kill the patient in order to kill the pain. As Jesus entered into the mystery of human suffering, he gives us a model of how we can care for others who are suffering, not by providing neat answers to the questions of human pain, but by being there. Suffering is not a question that demands an answer. It's not a problem that demands a solution. It's a mystery that demands a presence. Suffering is a mystery. We'll never fully understand it. And our calling is to be there with those who are suffering, to be the hands of Jesus, to share in the mystery of suffering, in hope that the meaning of suffering will be revealed, that suffering can be redeemed and changed. This is Stuart, who, again, I've told this story before, but very briefly I'll tell it again. Stuart was a close friend of mine at All Souls Church in London. He was quite a quiet, shy, introverted guy. He was an academic studying music theory. And then he was struck down by a horrible kind of cancer. And he was in terrible pain. The cancer spread through his body. He had several courses of chemotherapy. The tumor went away and then it came back. And then it was clear that he was close to death. And he was in pain, and I had a conversation with him, and I remember saying to him, if I could give you 3 months of pain-free existence, and then you were going to die, what would you do with those 3 months? And his answer really surprised me, because I thought he'd say something like, I'd like to finish my PhD. Or, in fact, what he said is, you know, if I knew I only had 3 months to live, what I would do is I would get out my address book and I would write a letter to every single person I knew and had met in my life, and I would tell them what's happening to me and try and share the gospel. And I was really surprised. That seemed something really unusual, but that's precisely what he did. And he got out his address book and he started writing letters to everybody he knew, sharing his faith and his story. And then as the days were going by and he was running out of time, he photocopied a letter and was sent that around. He'd only got to F in his diary and time was getting short. And then, quite peacefully, he was receiving palliative care. He did survive for several weeks, and then he slowly became weaker and weaker, and he died. And at his memorial service, there were over 400 people who had come to pay tribute to Stuart. Many people who were there just because they had received a letter. And I remember sitting in that very intense memorial service and thinking, in a strange way, I'm quite envious of Stuart. Stuart died well. He had the opportunity of saying things, of writing things, of having experiences which most of us don't have. And so dying well actually is an opportunity. It's an opportunity for reordering priorities, for restoring broken relationships, for saying goodbye, for fulfilling dreams, for finding new meaning and purpose, for preparing to meet God. Dying well is not just a negative, gloom-filled thing. Earlier on in my talk, I said that many Christian people say, I just want to die in my sleep. I want to die suddenly. I don't want to know what is going on. Is that really a good death? Is that really what God wants for us? Or could dying actually be a wonderful adventure, a way of learning new things about ourselves, about our family and our loved ones? So God's plan for this age is not to abolish human suffering, but is to redeem it, to bring blessing and healing out of evil and pain. Maybe God has more to teach you in the process of dying well, and maybe you can be a witness to others as you die faithfully, as you die in the light of the Christian hope. The mystery of human suffering is not new. It's a deep mystery from the dawn of time. But you know, in the words of C.S. Lewis, there's a deeper magic from before the dawn of time. And that's the story of the cross, the story of inexplicable evil, which is changed and converted and transformed into blessing and healing. And finally, we must care for dying people in the light of the future. We must care for people not only in the light of what they once were, but in the light of what, by God's grace, they are going to be. You know, when you love someone in the present, particularly a profoundly disabled person, or somebody with Alzheimer's disease, or somebody dying, when you love them with respect, with empathy, with love, you're pointing towards the future. You're pointing towards the hope of the resurrection. You're saying, this is not the end of the story. When we were loving my mother in that terrible state, we were saying, this is not the end of her story. And in the way we treat her with love and with care and with tenderness, we're not just looking back and saying she once was a wonderful person. No, Christian caring is pointing towards the future. It's saying there's more to come. Things that no eye has seen, that no ear has heard, that has no human heart has even thought about, is what God has prepared for those who love him. So Christian love only makes sense, it can only be intelligible in the light of the Christian hope. In 1 Corinthians 13, Paul has these wonderful words: love always protects, always trusts, always hopes, always perseveres. Love never fails. Now, you know, from an earthly perspective, it seems that all too often, love does fail. We pour out love on a disabled child, on a violent, disturbed adolescent, on a demented older person, and it seems pointless. It seems futile. It seems meaningless. I've cared for so many babies who died. All that love, all that care, all that attention, where did it go? But Christian hope teaches us and reminds us and rebukes us, love never fails. In secular thinking, life comes from nowhere and it grows to a gradual crescendo. You grow, you become stronger, you learn new skills, you know more things, it gets better and better, and then you hit 25. And after that, it's downhill all the way. Gradually, your skin's getting wrinkly, your brain cells are falling out, your joints are getting creaky, you're getting tired, and down and down and down and down, and eventually you go. That's it. That's the story. But Christian thinking is different. The path of the righteous is like the first gleam of dawn, shining ever brighter until the full light of day. I found this picture on the internet. It's two climbers in Alaska of a huge rock peak. And through the night, they climbed up the rock, hanging on in the dark with ropes until finally they got to the top of the peak. And in the dark, they waited for the dawn. And there over the horizon, slowly comes up that first blush of dawn. Now that's what Christian life is like. Slowly, imperceptibly, it's coming. It's coming. And we're called to live in the light of that coming dawn. Hope is to hear the melody of the future, and faith is to dance to that melody in the present. May God help us to do that by his grace. Amen.